From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. If you grew up reading American superhero comics with their narratives about divided cells and acts of emotional violence, if you were a young person dealing with what used to be called issues of gender conformity, there might be a perfect place for you to land. If you happen to be as talented an artist as my guest, editor, director, and now actor, Vera Drake, then you would have made a terrific movie called The People's Joker that folds all that stuff in and so much more. If you were to sort of combine, I guess, Terry Gilliam and Maya Darren and the brothers Quay and maybe some Bill Sienkiewicz, you might have some small taste of what it is she accomplishes in this very short film. Not long enough at 94 minutes. Vera, first of all, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much.
One of the things that I will ask you to do is to talk about the title, because it's a really kind of interesting declamation.
The title itself, The People's Joker, kind of came from the mission statement of like what the movie was. Like I used to have a web series called Hot Topics that was all about me just trying to get sponsored by Hot Topic so that I could finally have my high school emo girl phase, but as an adult, and the aim was to make that happen on Hot Topic's dime. That mission was never accomplished. but on that show, I announced to my followers that I was going to start hopefully making a Joker movie kind of based around my experience as a trans woman coming up in comedy. And anybody that wanted to help me do it should reach out. You know, I got this like overwhelming response from like hundreds of artists, many of whom were also queer and trans. Yeah. So the title itself really kind of came from that community effort. It kind of really did start as this like project among friends and just people in my artistic community so that we could keep ourselves busy in pre-vax COVID, because this was all started right around the time the shutdown happened.
I really do feel like, though, and as somebody who knows comics pretty well myself, there are so many things that thrill me, his throwaway lines and references. But the fact that comics are so much of it, superhero comics especially, are about what we talked about at the outset, the divide itself. And almost every person in the story is in one way or another wearing a mask.
All the themes of growing up, you know, coming of age, you know, these like identity struggles that you're talking about, like they're all there in these superhero texts. And I'd never seen anybody do that and take on these themes from a queer perspective and in like the genre, the superhero genre itself. So the aim really was to sort of not just show the trans experience, you know, using Batman characters, because there definitely is that, but really kind of illustrate how the trans experience, at least for me, really just was growing up and like coming of age and realizing who I am and what I want to say and how I want to say it. And I think those are things that all of us go through, regardless of whether or not, you know, where we fall on any sort of gender spectrum.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, that you use one character, sort of the love interest, Jason Todd, who really is this sort of pinup character for emotional violence. You can fold in another story about the character from Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns. I won't go into that too much because I don't want to spoil it too much for people. But choosing that character, who was just treated abominably and so cruelly in the comics, I just thought brought an extra emotional kind of frisson to the material.
The Jason Todd and Robin element of our story is one, it was an idea that came to me pretty early in the process, just because I love these comics. I feel like I haven't said that enough when I've been talking about this movie. Like, I love Batman so much. I wouldn't have spent 2 years of my life making this movie if I didn't love it an unhealthy amount. The Robin story is so fascinating to me because I mean, if you really do take Batman at face value, this like grown man with all the money in the world, still not over his parents' tragic death, then roping in like a teenage boy into like and training that teenage boy to fight crime.
Several teenage boys, we should say.
Oh, yeah, several. An army of children, basically. To me, like, I've seen it in the comics. Like, they definitely contend with that. But I've always wanted to see that on film, like really kind of talking about that relationship from the standpoint of perpetuating cycles of trauma, because that's 1,000% what it is. And I love Jason Todd so much. And that dynamic really did feel like the perfect ground to sort of cover that.
By the way, it's a treat. My guest, who seems to be comparing Bruce Wayne to Michael Jackson, is Vera Drew. Her film is Star Dread.
I will not go on the record for that.
her film is a star director, writer, and editor is the People's Joker. But again, that character who, for those of us who know, was subjected to really one of the most cruel twists of fates in terms of having his own fate be decided by the readers who voted against him and he lost by a handful of votes, and then folded into Carrie from Dark Knight Returns. I mean, I just think that alone could be its own movie.
I probably won't make that movie just based off the legal feedback I've gotten for this one. I'm glad it's a part of ours. And I think you brought up a good point, too. Like, I mean, the fan engagement with the character and the cruelty of the fan engagement, you know, I really do think of these stories as like living, breathing texts that do require audience interaction and participation, if anything. So, yeah, it felt appropriate in our kind of community project Joker movie.
Again, almost every character, major character who surfaces in the story, even your protagonist's mother, is wearing a mask or hiding a part of themselves. And I just wonder, as you were sitting down to write this, after you sort of jacked Todd Phillips' Joker and re-edited that as kind of a lark, if that's what you thought would be the through line for you, just this sort of constant state of revealing or people hiding themselves away.
One of my actually like favorite memories in this whole process was the first time I screened a work in progress version of this movie for people that worked on it and some of my closest friends. And Lynn Downey, who plays the mother character in The People's Joker, came up to me in tears afterwards, just saying like, it's a love story. It really is like this love story. I think it's a mother-daughter love story in that way. Like it's really about two people learning how to love and forgive each other and kind of seeing that echo in all the people that the main character in it interacts with. Like sort of like that's her template for how to be and how to love, and it's fractured. So yeah, I mean it's really kind of the main vehicle of the story, I think, that dynamic between the mother and daughter.
Well, I think she's right, because it's also about what power, or specifically getting the upper hand does to people, and what a corrupted kind of thing that is, and how that's really kind of subtextual in superhero comics, but it becomes this emotional fascism that is the core of your story.
That's what I actually loved about Todd Phillips' movie so much, was like it felt like one of the first times in a like mainstream superhero film, like we're really talking about institutions failing people and why people suffer from mental illness. And like, it's not just broken family systems. It's like the entire institution failed that character in that movie. So it really inspired me. And when making this, it was like, let's have that be the thing. Like, just because as a trans person, as a gay trans person, like I mean, I come from a lot of privilege. I live in Los Angeles. Like, I definitely am not constantly having my rights under siege, but like trans people are right now. And I really wanted to see that, like explore that kind of abuse of power and how that like ripples down and actually affects the children who are trans when they're growing up.
No, because that abuse of power hear, and I guess I find myself thinking, because he just passed away recently, of the book Martial Law is about how that kind of power, if it's handed to a victim of trauma, does become a kind of a fascist thing.
Completely, yeah. I mean, like, I really do. It's so cliche, but, you know, hurt people hurt people. Like, it really is, like, and I think particularly in the queer community, like, we're constantly just re-traumatizing each other as a result of the real enemy, which is fascism and all that stuff. Like, it really does trickle down and ends up creating more destruction within these communities, like, than just that initial attack.
But it's even about so much about institutions, really about how comedy has become itself an institutional purveyor of this kind of exclusionary and cruel behavior.
Modern comedy is so frustrating because it's this, like, disgusting smoothie of, like, oh, we're getting our freedom of speech taken away, and then people saying the worst possible thing they could possibly say and getting platformed for it. SNL decides elections. And SNL is part of our military industrial complex, and, like, comedy itself is constantly used for propaganda. And it really is just this kind of swamp of trauma and like negativity, as far as I'm concerned. But at the same time, for me, you know, like, it's where I figured out how to express myself. I was a drag performer for a little bit. I did comedy from the time I was like 13 till today. I'm still called a comedian, unfortunately. but yeah, I mean, like, it really was for me the place that I figured out who I was and how to express myself at the same time.
All this, the current, I think, iteration of comedy is about reacting to institutional behavior, right down to there's a strain in the People's Joker where you kind of alight on this idea of institutional rebels. And I'm not going to mention their names here because it's more fun for people to hear them in context. But how even that rebellion has become something that's a basically commercially viable behavior.
Everything kind of gets commodified. And it's, I think, the most disturbing thing that we are now seeing is really seeing, like, what 15 years ago would have been, like, radical leftism or whatever, like, actual real radical leftist ideas, like, seeing that in sort of, like, co-opted by institutions in power, it's really bleak. It's really bleak to see.
We'll take a break. My guest, who I will not call a comedian, but instead a director, editor, writer, and actor, is Vera Drew, whose film, which you cannot see, but I'm hoping that you will be able to, is The People's Joker. It's The Treatment, which you can hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. There's more to come. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The movie we're talking about, which has been kept away from theaters and streamers near you, is The People's Joker. The talent behind it is its star, director, editor, and writer, Vera Drew. And, I mean, we're talking about fascism, even like a throwaway joke with the Creeper, who any character that symbolizes that kind of fascism, it's that character.
Turning Creeper into, like, basically like a Jerry Springer type talk show host, because that's, like, already kind of like the vibe on whenever we've seen You're Wrong portrayed. Yeah, it makes perfect sense that he would kind of be this, like, three ring circus talk show host who's having transsexual reveal segments. And I really wanted to put one of those in this movie because, like, for me, like, those Jerry Springer segments were the only representation that I had as a kid. Like, the only time I saw women who are like me was, you know, kind of in this, like, Jerry Springer freak show context.
And that's what's interesting about the movie, too, is that so much, even the way it's lighted in some ways, is like a three-ring circus. And that kind of circus atmosphere that if you came up in the 90s, you saw the issues of gender identity treated in that way, I thought it was a really interesting visual subtext to give the movie.
what was really like fun about this process was like really leaning into like trickster mythology and how does the Joker actually stand up as like a mythic figure. I really wanted to play with like circus imagery and clowning and shamanic clown stuff too, is pretty prominent in the movie for that reason as well.
I have to ask you, because the movie was at its premiere at the Toronto Film Festival this year, and getting a chance to see it in the theater, what was that like?
That premiere at TIFF was the most beautiful night of my life. Like, truly just one of the most amazing experiences. I'd never seen anything that I had worked on, like, with that many people in one room. Every joke landed. Mr. Boop got an applause break. I was like, there's Mr. Boop fans in the audience? Hell yes. You know, I like it was an absolute dream, particularly after like the whole lead up to it, because there was Warner Brothers reached out to us like 6 days before we were supposed to premiere, saying that they wanted to review the movie to have an opinion on it, was the way they worded it. And they waited until the night before our premiere to tell us that they thought the movie was a copyright infringement, which every lawyer I've worked with on this film, which I've been working with lawyers since starting writing it, has told me this film falls under fair use. We do all the same stuff that a documentary would do. It's protected by copyright law. It does not infringe. But Warner Brothers felt differently, sent us a letter the night before we were set to premiere. And yeah, it was kind of this like the lead up to that premiere was 24 hours of like, OK, we're going to screen. OK, we're not going to screen. OK, we need to find a backup theater to show it in. OK, wait, no, we don't need that. We can screen. OK. And really, like, that all came down to TIFF really going to bat for me. Like, I can't believe, you know, you want to talk about like institutions of power. Like, it's the first time I've ever felt protected and shielded by a giant institution. And they negotiated with Warner Brothers, I believe with the head of Warner Canada, and said, you know, we have hundreds of people that are already bought tickets to see this movie tomorrow. So how about we show it once and then we go from there? We'll pull the rest of the screenings after it. And, you know, and thankfully we were able to work that out with them and have the premiere we had, because it was, again, just the most beautiful night of my life. Like, it was like a fairy tale. I couldn't believe that we got to watch that movie and in one of the oldest theaters in North America. Like, it was just, it was crazy.
It's funny you say fairy tale, because that's actually the first thing I wrote down in watching it. It plays out like a fairy tale in that way, with the cruelty comes out of nowhere. And this sort of cruelty is used, becomes this way to sort of comment on and extinguish innocence, which is always fighting to be heard. It feels very much like a fable to me.
I love fairy tales. You know, I am very reluctantly and shamefully influenced by Walt Disney. You know, like, I really do love fairy tale storytelling. And to me, like, you know, we hear about these characters all the time in the context of being modern myths. I now more than ever kind of believe that that's just more propaganda so that we could keep making these like government financed Marvel movies. You know, I do think of, you know, comic book characters as our modern myths. And I think myth exists so that we can understand ourselves. Joseph Campbell, it's like all about coming of age and finding yourself. So yeah, I really wanted to treat these characters with that reverence and use them as like, if they are actually myths, use them the way that myths are traditionally used.
Well, they're only state government financed. Well, except with the exception of Canada and most of Western Europe. Anyway, it's the treatment. I'm talking with Vera Drew, who's the star director, creator, writer, and editor of the film The People's Joker, which I'm hoping you'll be able to see one day. You can also get the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But You're talking about something that's really essential to American popular culture going back over a century, which is how central the hero myth is. And if you're a person who's considered marginal, then you're somebody who's watching this from the outside. And that insider blithe cruelty and outsiders struggling to be seen is really a fascinating way to approach this.
Because there is no trans representation, really. I mean, even still, there really isn't. I really did have to use pop culture and comedy to sort of figure out how to grow up and how to be me. And I think that is a very universal experience for a lot of trans people and especially trans women. You know, my context for understanding myself is superheroes. And the first time I really felt seen on film was when I went to go see Batman Forever when I was 6 years old at a movie theater in Baraboo, Wisconsin with my dad and my uncle Chaz. And we got to that scene where Batman is in the window and Nicole Kidman's in like her nightie and she's waiting for him. And she, you know, he comes through the window and she walks up to him and she's touching his rubber nipples because it's the Joel Schumacher movie. I don't know what it was. It was like watching that movie as a child. Like I felt seen somehow. Like I felt like I think that scene probably was like a very important sexual awakening for a lot of like straight men. But for me, it was like, oh, I'm a girl. I'm a pretty girl. I want somebody to look at me the way Batman is looking at her. And rubber nipples are cool.
I wouldn't argue with that. But what I would say to you is that sort of growing up, I always thought, especially because they used the color in the Joker character, they almost magenta like purples and the green. I always thought of him as being a gay character, actually. And it's one of these things that you get older and go, oh, that's never dealt with. But that character always seemed to me, and sort of in his way, sort of attacking the status quo that would not allow him to be seen as what he was.
Joker is the queerest character in, like... Like the queerest, not overtly queer character in the DC canon, as far as I'm concerned, for the reason you just said. And like, to me, trans people are gender anarchists. So who better than to like sort of mythologize that than the Joker? I mean, so many trans people I know that Todd Phillips movie resonated with them for the same reasons that I mentioned, like. Really, you know, we feel like we are kind of agents of chaos living in a society. Queer subtext has always been a part of the Joker character. Like David Bowie was an influence on Frank Miller's portrayal. You know, the Grant Morrison portrayal was very like almost like Batman and the Joker are like ex-boyfriends. So to me, it really was an easy analog to apply to the trans experience and my experience as like doing drag and stuff, because there was a period in my life where it was easier for me to look like a girl if I also looked like a ridiculous clown or a monster in the process of looking like a girl. And there's even a line in the movie where, you know, she's talking about how like, you know, the first experiences of going out dressed like a woman, it's easier for her to do it if she's wearing clown makeup because people are okay with clowns, but not trans people.
No, I mean, and it's funny you're saying that about all those comics. I always thought that last page of The Killing Joke, when the two of them are laughing, it's like there is this sort of understanding of Batman finally getting who the Joker is. But there's so many instances. I mean, that sort of that sort of anger in the Dennis O'Neill, Neil Adams. And by the way, congratulations on being maybe the only person in the history of movies to say Ra's al Ghul correctly. But but also that there's so much of that dynamic of and also in sort of dealing in subtextual terms with all the things that Batman was accused of by Dr. Frederick Wortham and those kinds of things. All that seemed to me kind of condensed and reduced into the struggle between Batman and Joker. And again, the idea of divided selves that we were talking about at the outset, except, you know, Batman's feeling the Joker is almost this kind of anger that the Joker is out and he's not.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's 1,000%, I think, what it is. It's just, they're not even like two ends of the good and evil spectrum. They're on some other, they're on some other spectrum of like, it's an intersection of trauma, expression, identity, getting left behind by society, getting left behind by your parents. Like, you know, like I feel like that line that you hear, and I mean, honestly, like a lot of Batman movies of, you know, we're not so different, you and I or whatever. Like, it really is true with the two of them. There's such a thin line separating them, and whether it's sanity or freedom and expression, they're really the same dude.
Also, one of the things, too, in terms of being simpatico is that what you did with this film was really kind of the ultimate punk gesture. And given who Todd Phillips is and how he got his start as a filmmaker, I would think if anybody embraced, at least in the abstract, what you're doing, it would be Todd Phillips.
Yeah, I'd hope so. I mean, like, I'm a huge fan of his. I mean, I love his G.G. Allen documentary so much, and his documentary about frats. Like, he has a punk sensibility. Like, I imagine he's heard of our movie by now. I'd hope. Just because the amount of money we've spent on PR. But, like, you know, I don't know how he feels about me, but I hope, yeah, like, even on, as you said, a academic level or something, he can just appreciate the punk rockness of what we did.
And especially given the kind of legal trouble he got into with his frat movie, I think if there'd be anybody who would empathize with what you're going through, it would be him.
Yeah, he might have some people that he could recommend that I could add to my legal team.
I have to ask you, though, given where we are right now, what does the future look like for the film?
Hopefully we can start screening again soon. We may or may not have already started screening again soon. I can neither confirm.
Are you reading a note from your lawyer?
Look, this movie is protected by fair use and parody and copyright law. I think it still has a shot at finding some sort of distribution model. But yeah, I'm hoping in the new year we can screen a little bit more and get this out to the people, because people really seem like they're really ready to see this movie.
I would agree with you 100%. My guest, who is a punk anarchist and a lover of popular culture, is Vera Drew, whose film, which is so full of ideas, it demands at least two screenings, I think, is The People's Joker. Vera, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Elvis. This is a lot of fun.
Shaking Up What She Loves. That's Vera Drew, the writer, star, and director of the as yet still barely seen film, The People's Joker. Conversations that take us from the past, present, and future of popular culture are all available to hear at kcrw.com/thetreatment. And I've been here for all of them. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Over the last 50 years, my guest has produced over 50 films, iconic movies such as Thief and American Gigolo to Top Gun to the most recent Top Gun Maverick. What Jerry Bruckheimer does as a producer is understand that the word motion in motion pictures is something to be taken seriously. There's so much movement in his films, from cars to submarines to, of course, airplanes and Top Gun Maverick. Jerry, first of all, it's great to have you back.
Thanks, Elvis. It's always good to talk to you.
I mean, I think, but it's so important to the way you work. And I just wonder if you were conscious that it's become such a part of really the kind of sensibility that your movies and your TV shows put across.
Yeah, it is. It's fun to have terrific action and that kind of velocity that we call it. But what's really more important is the emotion. If you don't have the emotion and good characters and good character themes, you really, none of them will work. The emotion is great. They're the icing on the cake, but it's always about the characters and the emotion and the emotionality of the story. I mean, Top Gun Maverick wouldn't be the success that it has become without the story and the characters' interaction and the emotion between, you know, Iceman and Rooster and Maverick, and all those dramatic scenes is what makes the picture work as well as it has for audiences and for critics.
Pete Bitchell, not named after me, is a grown-up in this movie in a lot of ways, but still trying to hold on to some part of what he was all those years ago.
Yeah, he's kind of searching for something. He's been out there for a long time, 35 years, doing what he loves doing. But he needed something else in his life. And what happens in this movie, he finds that something else.
What was your concern about going back to that? Because it's such a beloved piece of material, the original Top Gun, that people feel almost a kind of ownership over it, you know, like those characters, especially Maverick, belong to them.
Well, what's really interesting is the audience reaction initially, when they first walk in the theater, they had their arms crossed saying, all right, it can't be as good as the first one. So the minute you heard the tune, the minute you saw the carrier and what was going on the deck of the carrier, you relaxed. It kind of took you back 35 years ago, and you're usually there with your son or your daughter, just like their fathers or their grandparents took them to see the original Top Gun. What's interesting is when we tested the movie, it tested really strongly with an older audience, but it didn't quite hit the mark with a younger audience. But what happened is the movie ended up hitting everybody, got from 8 to 80. And not only here in this country, which is really interesting about this film, the grosses were bigger foreign than they were domestic. So it shows you this movie hit the world the same way. It showed great entertainment, really a well-made film, character study. It also gave you something that was, you felt good when you walked out.
But it also has going for it too, something that the original didn't, is that it's such an iconic piece of IP, really. And what you were talking about, that octane of the opening, using Danger Zone to sort of remind us where we are, that's a way of letting audiences know this is a continuation. It's not just a sequel.
Exactly right. And you know, we always get asked, why didn't you make it sooner? There were a lot of reasons we didn't make it sooner. First of all, we all had other movies going at the same time. So all our careers were moving forward, Tom especially. And the other reason is kind of the studios in those days, when you made a sequel, it was a money grab. They gave you less money to make the movie. And we didn't want to do that. I mean, Simpson was actually quoted that we'll never make a sequel because that was the conventional wisdom in those days. And we didn't want to tarnish that movie in audiences' minds with something that wasn't quite up to speed with the original.
Don Simpson said that. Even at one point, Tom Cruise said that it wouldn't be a sequel. It felt like all these things you were saying, the idea of doing it for less money, what that movie represented to people, it was almost daring you to make a sequel rather than jumping right on the train to do another.
We didn't want to cheapen the original, and Tom certainly didn't want to. It made him a worldwide star. He was already on the rise with Risky Business and some of the other things he'd been doing. But that movie captured the world. He tells me stories that when he was in Africa scouting locations, little kids would come up to him and say, Maverick, Maverick, this movie went so deep and so far into the culture of the world. You know, the jackets became big hits, the bomber jackets. So many things came out of this movie originally. And so Tom always said to me, Jerry, we're going to make another and we're going to hit a bullet with a bullet. And that's what we tried to do. And apparently the audience agreed.
It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. We're revisiting the fast and stepping into the present with my guest producer, Jerry Bruckheimer, whose new project, among many others, is Top Gun Maverick. But since we're talking about revisiting the past and sequels, there's the American Gigolo series on Showtime, which the idea of revisiting that and taking a bigger look at that world of sex workers is a really interesting notion to take on, too.
What studios and streamers love, they love things that are in the culture. In other words, pre-sold titles. And American Gigolo is a pre-sold title. It was a big success for Richard Gere and for Paramount at the time. And so they decided to revisit it. And we tried to do our best to do what we did with the original. And in other words, have a really interesting male lead involved in not only what he did for a living, but also there's a criminal element involved too.
What's interesting, we're talking about these movies of the 80s, which had that really almost mirror-like gloss to them. In the American Gigolo series, it doesn't have that kind of shine at all. It's a much, almost like a verite look at that world, isn't it?
Each time you work with an artist, whether it's a director or a writer, and in television, it's usually a showrunner, they have their own perspective on the material, and we encourage that. We encourage talented people to do what they do. And that's been a big part of my success. And the successful movies and television that we've done is because we find what we think are really talented people and give them the opportunity to show their talent to the world.
But what you were doing as a producer in those films that made your name was offering a kind of look that American films weren't really doing at the time. I mean, it was a break and a breakthrough, I thought.
Well, I always believed it's not radio, it's film, and you want to really hire people that are visually interesting and unique. So when you see a commercial for one of our films or a trailer, it looks different. There's a different feel to it. Audience might not understand what it is, but they know it looks a little different than a lot of other things that are that they're bombarded with.
But I thought, and I wondered too, part of that came from your advertising work and what advertising was doing at the time, and working with so many British directors who had done a lot of work in commercials, sort of saying, we can make movies look glossy and glamorous the way they had in a long time in those films in the 80s.
Coming out of commercials, I found a lot of very talented visual artists who were directors. And I felt if we could give them a really strong screenplay, they could add something really special and interesting to the visual style of the film. And that's sort of been my career. We're doing another Beverly Hills Cop right now for Netflix with Eddie Murphy. We just hired a director named Mark Molloy. His first feature, he's famous for a lot of the Apple commercials he did. But he's got a real style and a real sense of humor. And that's so hard to find, somebody who has style and a sense of humor. A lot of the comedians who end up being directors and doing terrific films, comedies, aren't trained in the visual field. So they have a different, whole different look to what they do. But we try to make everything look really interesting for an audience.
Among producers, you are a rarity that there's a visual signature that sort of tells that we're seeing something that belongs on the big screen. And I just wonder, because you talk about streamers and digital for Top Gun Maverick, if that was important to you to also create a movie that looked like it belonged on the big screen, even if you're watching it somewhere else.
Absolutely. It's so important. We did it with CSI, the director we hired to do our pilot, Danny Cannon. I saw a film that he did. He's a British director. And I thought it had a real interesting style and look. And I was able to convince the brass at CBS to hire him. It was a struggle to get him hired, but it became an enormous success. And Anthony Zeiker, who created the series, said, we're making feature television. So he coined something new based on what we accomplished with CSI. And it's still on. I mean, we just started our second season all over again after 16 years.
It's interesting that you've been doing this long enough that you get a chance to be CSI or American Gigolo or Top Gun Maverick. You're getting now the opportunity to revisit some of these things that people thought were sort of conclusive when they finished. And I wondered what that challenge is for you.
It's a real challenge. As you can see, we struggled to get Top Gun made, but we finally got there. It's the same thing all over again. You got to give them something a little different and yet feel the same, have the same kind of look and feel and emotion to it. That's what they want, especially Top Gun Maverick. You walk out of that theater, you feel a lot better than when you walked in. As a producer, what I try to do, and same thing with Tom Cruise, is try to make a movie that entertains people, that takes them away from their daily lives, gives them 2 hours of entertainment, forget about everything. My partner used to call it, we're in the transportation business, and we transport people from one place to another.
But it's got to be an issue for you, especially because there's so much content now, of creating something that's about scale. Because basically everything you do, and it's just clear, you want it to feel epic in some way, don't you?
Yeah, you want it to be, again, to be different. You want to take an audience somewhere else and take them away from their daily lives and give them the scale. Not everything has scale. You know, we did Remember the Titans, which wasn't a large budget movie or huge scale. It was a very small story, but became very successful in its own right and changed the culture of that small town. The kind of movies I like to make are either full-on entertainment, which is what we do with everything, or to tell stories about individuals that should be remembered that haven't been remembered. We did it with Remembered the Titans. We did it with Glory Road. We did it with Black Hawk Down. We did it with Veronica Guerin. Those are characters that changed things around them for the better, but chances are wouldn't have been remembered other than the film we made about them.
And that's something that you're always drawn to. There is a bigger than life character who has to deal with questions that come up around these people, be it Veronica Guerin or Pete Maverick and Top Gun Maverick. These bigger than life people have to come down to earth in some way. And I just wonder where that comes from for you, because more often than not, go back to Julian, American Gigolo. It's so often for you, that character is the center of the kind of stories that you're attracted to as a producer. And I think I wonder where that comes from.
It's interesting. I wish I knew myself, but I like to make movies I want to see. I mean, that's what I'm all about. I have no idea what you, Elvis, like or what an audience likes, but I know what I like. And I'm going to keep trying to make movies that I want to go see until somebody says, Jerry, it's over. The audience doesn't care what you want to see. So that's what I keep striving for. And so far, it's worked for me. But again, my career is built on all the fantastic talent that we've been able to work with, from the writers who wrote the great screenplays to the directors, to the actors in front of the camera, to the studio executives who lifted these projects and encouraged me to continue with them and then promoted them and distributed them properly. It's a huge village to make a successful movie. And it just doesn't start with just an idea. That's where it starts, with an idea. And then you got to bring it like blooming a flower. You have this little seed and you got to bring it to full bloom. And Maverick is something that we worked on for a long time. We held it out of the theater. We held it out for 2 years due to the pandemic. We really felt it was a big audience and theatrical experience. And I think what happened is, not only did it show the world how brilliant our technicians, our actors, our writers, our directors are that were entertained by this movie, but it also gave the studios confidence that you can have a movie that's number one in the theaters, was number one on streaming, and it's still number one in DVD sales. So you don't have to put a movie directly on streaming. You can actually put it in the theaters, get more notoriety, and still be a number one hit streaming. And also gave the studios confidence that you can make a movie for an older audience, and that's where this started, and they'll come out to see it. That's what happened with this movie.
See, as you're talking about this, though, I think about the lessons you must have learned from doing CSI and showing that an older audience can drive interest and keep ratings up and make something into an international showcase, which is what that show became. And this idea of trying to focus in on a demographic rather than do that, just try to make it again. I'm thinking, going back to these epic characters and these bold statements that these movies make. And you can't pick a movie or project you've done with hasn't been the case, Jerry. They're all dealing with the world kind of falling apart around them. And how do they make sense out of it?
Well, that's drama. You need that. And that's why we go to these movies. We go through dramatic through lines that captivate an audience and put themselves in those characters' shoes and want them to triumph. You know, I believe that you have to make a movie satisfying, or it doesn't always have to have an happy ending. But it has to have some sort of closure and completion. That's what we try to do.
I don't want to give this away for the 9 people who haven't seen Top Gun Maverick yet, but there's a climactic moment with Pete and his partner's son near the end of the film where it looks like it's going to take a really interesting turn. Seeing that moment, we think that happens so often in your work where the person we think is the hero has to finally come to depend on other people. Again, these bigger-than-life characters who come to realize that they are not sort of the driving force of the world. And I just thought that was an interesting point for that moment to hit, because, oh, that's when I said, even out loud, watching myself, that's a Jerry Bruckheimer moment.
I appreciate the credit, but it really comes down to the people we work with and the choices we make. You know, Tom Cruise is somebody who's not just a brilliant actor, and this is a terrific performance. It has enormous amount of subtlety that, the scenes with Iceman and the scenes with Miles Teller, Rooster, are very emotional scenes and very difficult to do. And he does it seamlessly and makes them so real. That's part of what we try to do. But Tom is such a driving force in the movies I make with him. He's a better producer than I'll ever be. He cares about the script. He works tirelessly. I mean, I can't tell you how many days we showed up on the set and we had new pages, because Tom and Chris McQuarrie didn't feel, and Joe Kaczynski, that we quite captured what we needed to. So we worked on it late at night to try to make it as good as we can. It's that care that you put into your movies that audiences appreciate. They don't really know what you've done, but they know it works for them. And that's what Top Gun Maverick did. It really worked for them. And as I said earlier, the critics also. It's rare that I get those kind of reviews for the films we make, but this one really captured everybody.
It's the treatment we're talking about, Bigger Than Life, with my guest, Bigger Than Life producer Jerry Bruckheimer, whose new project, among many others, is Top Gun Maverick. You can also show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. That's very generous of you to, and I have no doubt that Tom Cruise does the kind of work, but it's also a through line in your work. I mean, we can even go back to Farewell, My Lovely, for gosh sakes. These Bigger Than Life people who think they know and are sure that they know and find out that they don't know. And it comes down to, almost metaphorically, like the people you work with to put the movie together, the people they're surrounded with, to help them understand that you can't do this by yourself. And that's fascinating to me, that you've made a 50-year career going back to that as often as not.
Well, they're all character journeys. And that's what Maverick shows more than any of them, is his character journey. And you got it right from the beginning when you talked about the movie and you talked about the Maverick character. This is something that is ingrained in good drama. You try to, again, surround yourself with people who understand what terrific drama is and what audience will respond to. Look, we're not smart enough to know what an audience really wants. All we know is we try to do the best we can every time we take on a film or a TV show. It's try to create something that they'll want to leave their homes and go to a theater, or stay at home in a television and watch it on their TV screen, that captivates them more than what's around them on that same time period. Now it's so different, because now with you can record something, or you can watch something later, you can see it on streaming. So it's much easier than it used to be.
So often what's made you so successful is that there's been a kind of a Maverick sensibility that you have.
I guess I don't look at it that way. I find stories that I like, or articles or pitches, screenplays that we find. But another big part of my career, which we haven't talked about, is the music. Even going back to American Gigolo, where we had Call Me from Blondie, and today with Lady Gaga and the song that she created for us, so, and the other song that we have in the film. And it goes through the entire career. Hans Zimmer's been a great partner through the years. He's somebody who's written so many amazing scores for us. Lauren Bapp was now working with us on a bunch of different things. So music is a big part of what I do as a producer, to make sure that we surround our films with very emotional, melodic scores and songs that work for the film itself and also help promote the film.
Sure. I mean, then that goes back to the transportational thing you were talking about. As you said, that I literally flashed on that scene where Richard Gere is driving to Palm Springs. We just have about a minute of him on the road with a marauder score, which is, again, about keeping this thing in motion, wondering what he's thinking about. That's something that I also think about with you as well.
Music is so important. You know, the heat is on. There are so many songs that audience will remember for specific movies, and really help propel those movies emotionally. And that's what music does for you with the score. It tells the audience how you should feel about these characters during that particular scene and moves them in a certain way. We heard the Lady Gaga song back in L.A. where Paramount, Randy Spindloff, brought the song to us that she'd written for the movie. And we listened to it in a room with Joe Kosinski and myself. And we said, oh my God, this, what a fantastic song. We flew to London, the two of us, and went to Hans's studio and played it for Tom and Chris McQuarrie, because they were working on Mission. All three of them flipped over. And Hans said, look, I'm going to take this melody. It's such a good melody. I'm going to use it as a love theme. So the love theme of Top Gun Maverick is really based on that song that he heard.
Well, we're out of time. My guest, who continues to take your breath away, sorry, I had to do that, is Jerry Bruckheimer, producer extraordinaire. His new film's producer, of course, is Top Gun Maverick. Jerry, thank you so much for doing this. Always great talking to you.
Elvis, it's the same. It's been too long. We got to do this more often. Thank you so much.
Continuing with the Red Line Overload is producer and film industry legend Jerry Bruckheimer. His new art house production is a newly minted Golden Globe Best Picture nominee, Top Gun Maverick. Past interviews of Bruckheimer and many other mythic creative figures have been archived at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And with The Treat, two longtime faves of mine who should have done this show a long time ago, Gilbert and Javier Hernandez, whose seminal comic, Love and Rockets, just celebrated its 40th anniversary. Lost Bros and another couple, two films that kept their childhoods alive.
I'm Gilbert Hernandez, and this is The Treatment.
All right.
The one movie I've probably seen more than any other, over and over, is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, you're looking good, baby.
I mean, I liked the movie, and then one day it was on TV, I guess, and I started watching it again, and for some reason, I got addicted like heroin. Every night, I had to watch a part of that. And it went on for months. Literally, every day, I had to watch a part of that movie.
You gotta start real slow.
It was a break, vacation or something like that. And I got back to it, and I couldn't get into it anymore. You know, my brain absorbed every line, every camera angle, every acting moment, everything.
They haven't hurt you?
Not yet, I ain't. But that can all change. Like that.
and it is super amazingly indulgent. You know, really a guy makes a movie about wanting to be in a Lancer TV show? That's like beyond something I would come up with, you know, or if I did, it would only be like a page, you know, and here's a whole film about it.
Bengal Lancers.
The tension in the film, because it's the Manson, you know, story, the Manson killings and stuff. And that doesn't happen till the very end, the nutty version. It doesn't happen till Grant. So there's a tension the whole time that you're not really sure, you know, what's going to jump out at you, you know, in a story-wise.
So George gave you all permission to be here?
Of course he did.
And you all take care of him?
Oh, we take care of George. We love George.
Well, is there anything wrong with me saying hello to an old friend?
Because I remember I was a little kid, and I remember hearing, you know, the Manson killings and this and that. And I thought, this is the most insane thing I've ever heard. And then a week later, or 2 weeks later, we find out, oh, it's just a bunch of girls who did it. Get me out of here, you know. So that's what I was sort of expecting watching this film, and then it turned out to be just a nutty film. So I just loved it.
I'm Jaime Hernandez, and this is The Treat. For many, many years, To Kill a Mockingbird was my favorite movie. And I think it stayed my favorite for a long time because every 2 or 3 years, the meaning of it changed for me. It started when I was a very young kid, and Gilbert saw it the night before. And he told me about this movie, but he told me about it like an 8-year-old talking about it. And I was like, what is this, a scary movie? You know, Boo Radley, all that stuff. And I remember being like, what the hell is he talking about?
Well, the one thing, he has a boy named Boo that he keeps chained to a bed in the house over yonder.
And then I finally saw it, and I was just dazzled. But what I was dazzled with was these little kids going through a scary movie, you know, where it was about being scared of the dark and being scared of crazy people and all this stuff.
Once I heard him scratching on our screen door, but he was gone by the time Atticus got there. Wonder what he does in there. Wonder what he looks like.
That was the first movie I ever saw where I related to the kids. I was their age, yet I found something different in them than I did in a Disney movie.
To begin with, this case should never have come to trial. The state has not produced one iota of medical evidence that the crime Tom Robinson is charged with ever took place.
You know, and I used to be so bored at the courtroom scene. And when I got older, I started going, wow, these kids really are interested in stuff. And they get in the middle of all this stuff going on. And then years later, I started going, ah, civil rights. Oh, boy, you know, we're tackling serious issues here. You know, and I started to be, like, more concerned with that.
And Tom Robinson now sits before you, having taken the oath with the only good hand he possesses, his right.
The world in it just changed over the years, and I just saw different things to be influenced by at different ages in my life. I'm interested now that we talk about it to see it again, because I haven't seen it so long.
The Treat, from Jaime Gilbert Hernandez, who just gave the world another treat. A gorgeous box set of their comic, Love and Rockets, to commemorate its 40th anniversary. Past editions of The Treat, such as illustrator and graphic novelist Adrian Tomina on a film that set his heart ablaze, can be found at kcrw.com/thetreat. Rebecca Mooney edits and produces the program, which is mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Thanks this week to Anna Buss and Laura Kandarajan for help. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.